So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. On June 25, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that federal courts have no jurisdiction in gerrymandering cases involving reapportionments done by state legislatures and governors. It was a very important ruling for Wisconsin, which had Gill versus Whitburn and other cases pending in federal courts. To discuss what happens next on the issue of redistricting, I want to thank to my left David Cannon, a political science professor at UW-Madison. Jay Heck is executive director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. Robert Yablon, is assistant professor, UW-Madison Law School. Thanks very much for coming in. Great. I want to open with a summary, just three sentences, of what Chief Justice Roberts wrote. Okay, let's start there. Partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts. That old standard, one person, one vote requirement, does not extend to political parties. It must not mean that each party must be influential in proportion to the number of its supporters. Last sentence. None of the proposed tests for evaluating partisan gerrymandering claims meet the needs for a limited and precise standard that is judicially discernible and manageable. 5-4. Surprised? Law profs? Go ahead.
Well, on that first point, let me take the first point on this idea that we don't have this manageable standard. The Chief Justice is simply wrong about that, that we have now several lower court cases that did develop exactly the kind of test he was calling for, including in Wisconsin, but also then in Michigan, Ohio, Maryland, all in North Carolina, all of these lower courts had developed exactly those kinds of manageable tests to tell you when it was a constitutional violation of partisan gerrymandering. Like, was the minority party really being hurt in an unconstitutional way by the way district lines were drawn? And when you combine that then with the fact that he's ignoring this huge body of work in political science that gives you those tools, combine that with the roadmap that was presented in the majority opinion in the Wisconsin case, in the Gill-Whitford case, you know, where in the majority opinion they say basically if you use a district-based standard of harm, not a statewide standard that we had used in the initial round, if you can show alternative maps that actually can show that, yeah, this is a more fair way to do it, and you show intent to discriminate, those three things are all sort of presented as here's what you need to do now when we remand this back to the lower courts. All of that was presented, and we were in the process of building that record, building that case in Wisconsin, and then they pulled the plug. And all of a sudden, we can't do this anymore, when just several months earlier, the same court, minus Justice Kennedy, of course, said that we could do this. And so that's what changes.
Send it back on a standing ruling.
Yeah, exactly. But with the kind of guidelines of what we could do, and then they all of a sudden say, oh, we can't do this anymore.
Biggest surprise, Professor?
I wasn't that surprised because as this litigation was playing out at the earlier stages, everyone thought that it was going to turn on Justice Kennedy, that he would be the deciding vote. And when he left the court last summer, I think that the plaintiffs in all of these cases knew at that point that they had an uphill battle and that they were going to try to convince the Chief Justice to come along. But he had shown a lot of skepticism in Gill versus Whitford when it was up at the Supreme Court last year about the courts getting involved, and he stuck to that. So I don't know that it's a big decision, but given the court's composition, I don't know that it was a shocking decision.
Thank you. Jay, you and I are the non-lawyers here. That's both bad and good. But you've been working on the reapportionment issue for decades.
Yes.
Your reaction?
Well, it wasn't a surprise, frankly. When Justice Kennedy resigned last summer, was replaced by Brett Kavanaugh, the writing seemed to be on the wall. The thing I find amusing, I thought it was a cowardly decision, by the way. They punted rather than, as David said, looked at the standards that were established. They've introduced a new word into our lexicon. I'd never heard justiciable before. Apparently, this is not justiciable. It clearly is. But I wasn't surprised. You know, when we started embarking on redistricting reform well over 10 years ago, we never thought the courts were going to be the solution. We always thought that the Supreme Court, because of a decision in 2004, was not going to be in favor of adjudicating partisan gerrymandering. And we knew it's up to legislators and it's up to the people they represent to really get this done. So not surprised, very disappointed, however.
Well, professors, I want to ask this. The court is still maintaining the right to rule on racial gerrymandering,
right.
and one person, one vote, correct? So they have kept those in its jurisdiction, sir?
As of now, that's right. And so on behalf of the lawyers, let me just say, justiciable is a word. They didn't just make it up for this opinion.
Thanks for that correction.
That is right. But as Justice Kagan pointed out in her dissent, it's the first time that they've applied this concept of non-justiciability in this context.
Right.
You know, elsewhere in the political process, we have a lot of judicial involvement. The one person, one vote doctrine. The court has overseen voting rights in various ways. The court is very involved in campaign finance cases. The court has been involved in reining in political patronage. But in this context, specifically partisan gerrymandering, the Supreme Court said, we just don't think that there are discernible and manageable standards here. And, you know, how that squares with its involvement in all of these other areas of the political process is you know, a little bit of a difficult case that the majority didn't necessarily fully make in this opinion.
Well, you alluded to the dissent, and I want to quote from Justice Kagan's dissent, just three sentences. For the first time ever, this court refuses to remedy a constitutional violation because it thinks the task beyond judicial capabilities. The partisan gerrymanders in these cases deprive citizens of the most fundamental of their constitutional rights, the rights to participate equally in the political process, to join with others to advance political beliefs, to choose their political representatives. Last sentence. The partisan gerrymanders here debased and dishonored our democracy and enabled politicians to entrench themselves in the court. She spoke for four justices, indicating the deep division, not only on this but others. Any comments on her dissent?
Yeah, well, she says it's a sad day for democracy, and she's right. It was. Well, I was not shocked by the decision either. I think what was shocking is the court pulling itself out entirely
right.
from this area of litigation and saying that we won't even be involved at all anymore. So I think, you know, Kagan is right that this was really irresponsible of the court to duck this because it's only going to get worse now. That you know, the tools we have to gerrymander are so much more sophisticated than they were even 10 years ago, so precise. We can slice and dice these districts in a way that give extreme partisan advantage. And so I think you're going to see something even in this next round possibly that exploits a loophole that hasn't been exploited yet. But now that we know that anything goes, there are 12 states in the country that don't even have a contiguity rule, meaning that you could have congressional districts that aren't even touching
right.
at all. And so it would be possible for a state legislature to pack a district that was, say, 95% Democratic and just by picking up homogeneous precincts from around the state.
With no
common boundaries at all. So there are 12 states with no contiguity law for congressional districts, and there are five more states that don't have a compactness rule. And so you could see extreme gerrymandering of the likes of which we have never seen now that the court has basically given the green light to this.
And some states, as you know, are connected by highways.
Well,
so
right.
Yeah, we're
pushing the boundaries,
right,
but
so
now
we just
give
it.
Right.
But the one thing I want to say, I mean, Justice Kagan's absolutely right. I mean, if you are a Democratic voter in Wisconsin or a Republican voter in Illinois or Maryland, your vote simply does not equate to the votes of people that vote for the majority party. And the classic example was in Wisconsin in 2018, when Democrats swept all the constitutional offices and there were 53% of the votes for the state legislature, for the assembly, people voted for Democrats, and yet they yielded 36%. Now, if that is not a violation of people's voting rights, I don't know what is.
But as I make it my way through the Justice Roberts' majority opinion, he says the framers of the Constitution were well aware of the implications of gerrymandering, and they are leaving it to the states with federal court oversight on racial and one person, one vote. So does this shift it back to all the states, back to Wisconsin, our legislature, governor, and Supreme Court? Is that the outcome here? Professor?
Yeah, that's the bottom line, right? Federal courts are not going to be in this business. And so that means that in states that have direct democracy mechanisms, Wisconsin's not one of them, but states that have referenda, ballot initiatives, the people directly can try to make change, and that's happened in a number of states. They can try to make change through the legislative process, and occasionally that's worked out in places, especially if you have divided government, maybe a compromise is struck. Or you can turn to the state courts, and states have their own constitutions with their own requirements, some of which are more specific than the federal constitution. And so there have been instances elsewhere in the country in which state courts have reined in gerrymandering, and I'm sure many more are now going to be asked to do the same.
Do all state constitutions, you think, demand equal districts of some sort? What do you think?
Well, population-wise, they have to.
Yeah, right. Already one person, one vote is, for sure.
Look, I'm redistricting.
Well, right, right. No, but it does vary from state to state. Some states do have stronger either constitutional or statutory protections for these ideas.
Where does Wisconsin rank,
Professor? Well, we're not in very good shape because, as Rob noted, that we don't have the initiative process, so voters can't do anything about it. You have a state legislature right now that is controlled by one party, and the leadership has indicated they're not interested in a nonpartisan redistricting kind of process. And so when that's the situation, there really isn't much recourse. And we have a fairly conservative state Supreme Court. So even if some plaintiffs did litigate this question in state court, you're not going to have a very sympathetic ear in state courts. That's why in a lot of states they would go the federal route, but now that's closed off. So in a state like Wisconsin, I don't think there is anything in the short run that's going to be able to address this in the next couple of years anyway.
The thing I want to say was one of the most important questions in the future, 2021 and 2022, as a result of this decision, is what will happen, and let's suppose that the Republicans maintain their majority in both houses in 2020, likely given the configuration. Governor Evers, of course, will be there.
You're saying the maps are not going to change.
Maps will not change. The maps will not change, and unless there's a huge wave election that we don't foresee right now, the legislature is still controlled by the Republicans. They will push forward partisan maps. They'll try to do them like they did in 2011. The governor will veto them. So the question with regard to the litigation, though, is that what's happened in Wisconsin, when that's happened in the past, is they've gone to a federal court, and the federal court has generally split the difference or come up with some compromise. And here's the question I'm concerned with. Will this decision impact the ability of the federal courts then to step in and draw the maps in a compromise form, or will they just step off of it and leave it to the state Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and it's hard to know. I don't know, Rob, if you have a better sense of that.
There's going to be a fight over where the lines should be drawn, and you're right. In the past, it has been in federal court, but there actually are some fairly recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have suggested that federal courts ought to be deferential to the policies that states are articulating for how they want to draw their lines. There is some case law that maybe people could point to suggest that these cases are better adjudicated in state courts, and so. That's going to be fought very, very vigorously, I think, which court will ultimately decide on the lines. And I don't know the answer to that.
So this is probably one big issue that just emerged before the next April Supreme Court election.
The state Supreme Court.
The stakes
absolutely.
Are even higher there. Yes.
Okay, as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what has happened? Gill versus Whitford gone, dismissed?
Done.
Were there other pending cases involving Wisconsin that have been dismissed or will be dismissed?
I think there were any redistricting cases.
No other redistricting ones. But other states are affected
other states,
as well.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah.
Could this decision be overturned? I mean,
5-4 decision.
Well, it's a 5-4 decision, but Justice Ginsburg is 86 years old. Justice Breyer is 80 years old.
True.
So any chance of this being overturned eventually?
Yeah, I wouldn't say this is anything like a decision that is going to have the a solid precedent that will be respected no matter what, because it is such a contentious issue. You have such strong dissents in the four. And so I think if you would have a Democratic president elected in 2020 and a Democratic Senate and an opportunity to replace one of the conservative five with a liberal judge, I think this is definitely the kind of thing that could be overturned if just the composition of the court changes. Because we can see, just even with Kennedy's leaving, the median justice just shifting a little bit, mm-hmm. the outcome of this case changed. You would not have had this outcome had Kennedy still been on the court. And so if you can replace one of the five conservatives with a real liberal, I would say there's no doubt this case would be overturned.
Rob, where does this rank in terms of Citizens United and the Shelby case, and now we have the redistricting ruling? So three major decisions involving our political process over the last 9 years. Where does this one rank?
Yeah, I mean, those might be the big three. I don't know if I could rank them. They've all had huge consequences for our system. This decision is so recent that the consequences remain to be seen. I mean, a hopeful take on this decision is maybe the Chief Justice will be proven right in the sense that, you know, one thing that he predicted was that this is a problem that the political process could be capable of dealing with. And so, you know, in a way, the fact that the courts have stepped back from this now now means that, you know, people who are involved with this issue are really going to have to push for change through politics, and they can try to make this a more salient, resonant issue. And that may well happen. So, I mean, the full story of this one is not yet written.
Yes, and I want to read one sentence from Justice Roberts just on that subject. He said, "This issue is not void and dead across our nation." And here's a sentence. "States are actively addressing the issue through state constitutional amendments and legislation placing power to draw electoral districts in the hands of independent commissions, e.g. Iowa, mandating particular districting criteria for their mapmakers, or prohibiting drawing district lines for partisan advantage." One sentence from Justice Roberts saying, hey, it's a state issue.
Right.
So going forward, Mr. Activist, on this issue, the League of Women Voters put out a call for action today.
We did last week, yeah.
And you did, yeah. Common Cause did. Ask your legislators to co-sponsor SB 288 and AB 303, and at least hold a public hearing. Whence goeth activists like you on this issue?
Yeah, and that's what we have to do. It's and what we would like to put in place by 2021 or 2022 is what the system they have in Iowa, nonpartisan entity that draws the lines. The legislature still votes on it, but the lines are drawn by the equivalent of the Legislative Reference Bureau here in Wisconsin, according to a set of strict criteria. Very simple things like squares, rectangles keep counties together, the things that make sense that we haven't done here in Wisconsin and certainly didn't do in 2011. So that's where the energy has to be. Now, the other thing is that we're concerned about as reformers and looking forward is what happened in 1962 in Wisconsin when we had a Democratic governor and we had a Republican legislature. John Reynolds, as you know, was the Democratic governor. And at that time, the Republican legislature decided to pass their maps. And they wanted to do it in the form of a resolution rather than in a law. And as yes. you know, a resolution doesn't require...
I mean, it goes around the governor.
It goes around the governor. So those are the kinds of things that we're also looking out for. And you know, we want to make sure and stay on guard that they don't try to manipulate the process with their big majority in the legislature to hold on to this and even not allow the governor to participate in the ultimate decision.
Jay, you and I heard the rumor, the Capitol rumor, that they were going to try to do this by resolution. That was at least discussed.
Yes.
Do you believe there was discussion?
Oh, I'm sure they're discussing every option. Absolutely. And I mean, the question is, how will the courts treat it? I mean, in 1962, they treated it one way, but with this Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court backing off from this issue. I mean, that's a real concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the Democrats could get a public hearing on either SB 288 or AB 303, and you professors were testifying before that committee, what would you offer in terms of ways to go forth, Rob?
Ways to go forward, meaning ways
action to... Action in the Capitol?
Action on getting a bill passed,
yes,
or action on
the Iowa model?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a number of different ways that states have done this, and I don't know that there is one right answer. Right, there are some states that have bipartisan commissions that are totally separate from the legislature. There are other states that use Iowa uses something that's more part of its legislative apparatus. Mm-hmm. There are differences in the criteria that you consult. You know, it makes sense that you would want to have criteria. Contiguity, compactness. There are some states that actually, though, have affirmatively prioritized partisan balance, and so there are questions about whether that's something that ought to be a consideration as well. So, you know, I think the Iowa model has worked very well for decades, and it's probably one of a number of positive directions that you could take this.
And more importantly, we're all united behind it. All the reformers are united behind it, and all the legislators.
And I think the Iowa model has another advantage, which I think it's more immune to constitutional challenge than the separate commissions. So you have the commission model that's completely separate from the state legislature, can be challenged on Article 1 grounds that says that, hey, the state legislatures really have to be involved in this process. And so that if those commissions, I think, will continue to be challenged on that basis. Whereas with the Iowa model, the state legislature still has to approve that plan, up or down, that the commission came up with. And so that I think, is a stronger model in terms of being able to survive.
We'd have to amend the Wisconsin Constitution to adopt the California style, for instance,
yep.
because the legislature is responsible in Wisconsin. California the citizens can accomplish that.
Well, Jay,
and that's an arduous task.
Were you very happy? Was Common Cause very happy with what the governor recommended on February 28th when he put this redistricting process?
We urged him to, absolutely.
And within weeks, the Republican
we knew that would happen.
Dumped it.
We knew that was going to happen. But the reason we wanted it in the budget for the first time in 10 years, it received a public hearing, because during the Joint Finance Committee hearings in April, four hearings, that issue was spoken about and it was enunciated, and nobody testified against it. Dozens of people testified for it. There is tremendous popular support, and as has been cited, the Marquette poll, 62% of Republicans want a nonpartisan redistricting system in Wisconsin. The only people that really want this are Voss, Fitzgerald, and some of their rank and file. I mean, those are the people that want to keep this.
Right. But last week, when Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald was asked about this, he said, the party in power has the right to draw these lines, and we are not going to revisit this issue until after the 2020 census. So it doesn't sound like SB 288 or AB 303 are going to get a public hearing.
But that's true.
I want to come back to what you said. Is there more public understanding and support of this issue? I had lunch with former Senator Dale Schultz, who you've had, you and former Senator Cullen, out talking about this issue.
Sure.
He said 3 years ago, we had to explain redistricting and reapportionment. We don't have to explain it anymore. Is there more support or understanding of the issue?
Vastly more support, and big crowds everywhere we go to speak about
Wisconsinites
this.
Are, to use the governor's term, connecting the dots.
They
on
are
this
connecting
issue?
The dots, because what they don't like is what's happening in the legislature, the paralysis, the polarization, the fact that major things that they voted for are not being even considered by the legislature in the policymaking process, and they finally have figured out that it's because nobody loses, nobody fears the citizens, nobody fears elections, because everybody has safe districts.
Right.
So people have connected, absolutely.
Right. And I think another thing why this is, the political dynamic has changed here, is that people are understanding now this is something where politicians are serving their own interests, not the people's interests. And it's also an issue that's not a Democratic or Republican issue, at least nationally. Now, here in Wisconsin, it has the partisan tilt to it because Republicans are in charge of the state legislature. But in general, this is a majority party, minority party issue. It's not a DNR issue. It's majority party versus minority party.
Right.
And so one thing that the public, I think, is reacting to now is seeing that politicians are doing this to preserve their power, and that's the only reason they're doing this. It doesn't make the country more representative, more better off. In fact, it's the opposite.
So there's more understanding of that adage that I hear so often in the Capitol. Lawmakers are picking their constituents instead of the other way around.
Correct.
The biggest thing is that voters have finally understood that their vote simply doesn't matter in so many elections.
Yep.
So they've lost their own personal power to impact elections. If everybody's in a safe district, then their vote is almost meaningless because the outcome's already decided, and people want their ability to be able to choose. But they
want
it back.
I'm a skeptical reporter. Give me a benchmark. Give me the next thing that has to happen to prove your thesis that there's so much more understanding of this issue publicly than there was 3-4 years ago.
Well, I would say that in the near term, there has to be enough pressure asserted on the Wisconsin legislature, and particularly on Republican legislators, to get them to convince Voss and Fitzgerald that they have to save their own skins, have a public hearing on this and air this issue. So that's the first thing. And then if that happens, then I think we can move forward with even more.
I would say, anecdotally, I was struck in the 2018 election, when you had newspapers around the state asking candidates about various issues. One of the issues that was routinely on the list was redistricting and gerrymandering. And that was not the case 4 years ago, 8 years ago. And so I take that as a sign that the issue has become more salient. And I think looking forward, so will that happen again in 2020? And in particular, we do, as you mentioned, have a state Supreme Court race coming up in the spring of 2020.
Yes.
State Supreme Court now has an even bigger role than they did before the Supreme Court decision.
Right.
And so to what extent does this become an issue in that race? I think that'll be another indication of the salience of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we see what's happened around the country where voters have had a chance to vote on this in Michigan and Utah and Colorado, states where this was up for a vote. It gets overwhelming support every time it's on a ballot. And so that Marquette poll, showing that, again, over 60% of Republicans Republicans favoring this. A majority party can only resist that kind of sentiment for so long, that we are fundamentally still a democracy. And to have, you know, that large percentage of the electorate behind an issue, eventually, it won't probably happen in this cycle, but eventually I think it will change.
Well, I want to speak to that. Jay, you're in the business of counting heads,
right.
Counting numbers.
Right.
If all 36 Assembly Democrats are in favor of one of these bills, AB 303, now you have four Republicans that have publicly said that.
Yeah.
36 plus 40. 4 is 40.
Sure.
40 doesn't pass anything in the Assembly.
You're still 11 short.
So
10 short.
Are you hopeful that instead of four Republicans, you can nudge a few over the line
that
here?
That's the strategy. The strategy would be to build enough pressure in some of those districts by constituents to force that to happen. And in the Senate, as you know, the margin's even closer. It's currently 19-14.
And how many co-sponsors of
this? There's no Republican sponsors in the Senate. I think Fitzgerald has been tougher than Voss on making sure people don't co-sponsor it. But we know in talking to Republican legislators that there's some support for it. Again, this is a very difficult thing. I'm not trying to cast an illusion here that somehow this is just going to pop forward and this is going to happen. It's going to take sustained pressure over the next year and a half.
Well, the other political thing that can come into play here is the 2020 election. You know, that's a big wild card. We have no idea how that's going to turn out. It could go anywhere from, you know, Trump being elected with a healthy margin to a Democratic landslide and anything in between. And so if it does end up being a really good year for the Democrats, you could see the control of the Senate flip. You could
see
Democrats picking up, you know, quite a few seats in the Assembly. Yeah. So you look at the results in the Assembly. The Democrats were the ones who were packed. Republicans were concentrated between 50% and 60% of the vote. They had like 30 districts between 50% and 60% of the vote. And so there are a lot of districts that are in play. And they were close in 2018. And so if you get another election, so let's say, you know, some other Trump scandal happens and the president's weakened substantially and Democrats have a great election, you actually could see some real movement, not only in the Senate, but in the Assembly. And that changes the political equation a lot.
Yeah, although there weren't that many close elections in the Assembly or the Senate in 2018. Not many within 10%, which is the margin you're looking at, and that's the problem with the gerrymandering, is it's created this solid hold. But nevertheless, in a sweeping landslide election, right, anything could happen. That's
how
right.
effective can the governor's bully pulpit be on this issue?
Very effective.
He pointed to the 70% support Medicaid expansion, didn't get that. Right. So, but he did say when he was asked about this that this is one of my top priorities. Do you expect him to pretty effectively wield that? I referred to it as the bully pulpit on this issue?
He has to. Yes, absolutely. He has to for several reasons. Number one, he doesn't want to see the majority of the other party get larger. He wants to shrink it. But secondly, you know, it's his agenda is at stake here. So if he wants to accomplish anything in the next 3 years, he's going to have to be able to have, you know, at least a working majority of some sort, a coalition, in order to get stuff done. So absolutely, this is very important to him. Plus, it's the right thing to do. I mean, he understands that. He understands. And he's not advocating that we go to a Democratic gerrymandering. Or are we? We're saying everybody should be the same, that everybody should be treated the same. So that's an important distinction between partisan gerrymandering and what reformers are after.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, but Rob, this question. The governor in a recent statement said, I will veto the next set of maps that are not fair. Does that, again, then take it to our Supreme Court? Shift it potentially there?
It takes it to a court. So as we were talking about before, you know, it's unclear what court ultimately will decide it. But if the legislature and the governor can't agree on a map, there by law needs to be a new map in place. But for the 2022 elections to comply with the one person, one vote doctrine, which still exists, so a court, state or federal, has to step in to draw a map then.
Okay, final question for each of you. We're almost out of time. Lessons learned from the U.S. Supreme Court decision and the impact in Wisconsin. You each have about 20 seconds. Go.
I would say the shift in power to the states, because clearly this is an area that the federal courts now are saying we're not involved, is shifting power back to the states.
Jay.
And I'd say, you know, the courts are not the answer. I mean, you can't look to the courts for anything but a temporary fix, maybe a minor adjustment. I think for too long, reformers have hoped that the courts were going to solve this problem. It has to be done by the grassroots, and it's a long, sustained battle. This isn't something that's going to happen right away. So people have to dig in for the long haul.
Rob, last word on lessons learned?
I agree with both of those lessons. Those are both good ones. And you know, I think that the takeaway is very strongly from this, that not just on the issue of gerrymandering, but on other issues with respect to the political process. You can't rely on this Supreme Court. I mean, people really are going to have to remain engaged at the grassroots level on all of these issues, whether it's the individual right to vote, campaign finance, and all the rest.
Great discussion. I want to thank David Cannon, Jay Heck, and Robert Yablon, excuse me. For discussion of such an incredibly important issue.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, thanks.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol. Wisconsin Eye would not exist without generous donors like you. Please visit wisi.org to make a donation today.